From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the program, Wisconsin ranks near the bottom of the list for access to dental care for poor children. What's going on?
Medicaid has become kind of like a hunting license for dental care. It gives you the opportunity to try and find a dentist who will treat you and or your children, and that can be a trial.
Whether it's Super, Blue, or Crescent, we'll consider the moon's many faces. We learn about a new Milwaukee Encyclopedia project taking shape at UWM.
There's things about Milwaukee that are really interesting stories that didn't happen anywhere else, but also have a peek at bigger things that were going on in the world.
And mark the 20th anniversary of the Clements Famous Racing Sausages. Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. Welcome to Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. It's wonderful to have your company this morning. People on both sides of the same-sex marriage debate in Wisconsin are beginning to process what yesterday's Supreme Court ruling means to the issue here. The High Court struck down the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, clearing a path to qualify same-sex couples for receiving federal benefits. WUWM's Latoya Dennis talked with people in Wisconsin who stand to be affected by Wednesday's ruling, and she joins us now in the studio to talk about what she's heard. Welcome, Latoya.
Hi.
Well, how significant do people in the gay rights arena in Wisconsin look at this Supreme Court ruling on DOMA?
Well, they definitely see this as a landmark ruling. I mean, they are completely excited about it, although there are still some concerns. But the people that I spoke with say that this is basically one step closer to equality, which is all that they're seeking.
Do they look at it as emboldening the effort to revisit LGBT rights issues here in Wisconsin?
Not necessarily. What they do say is that while they're not done fighting, and so they say that marriage is not the end all be all for them. So this is a great step, although it does not legalize gay and lesbian marriage here in the state. What it does is it says that if you get married in another state where it is recognized and you come to Wisconsin, then your federal benefits have to be recognized.
They follow you.
But it does not say that the state of Wisconsin has to recognize your union, which the state of Wisconsin passed a constitutional amendment back in 2006 saying that marriage is between a man and a woman. So while the lesbian gay community here, they aren't necessarily saying that tomorrow we're going to go out and fight for equal opportunities here. What they say is that there are still issues concerning poverty, concerning housing, concerning equal treatment that they are looking at and that they are concerned about and that I do believe they will try and tackle in the future.
Well, are there any immediate implications for policy here in Wisconsin given this ruling?
You know, that's a question that everyone is asking right now, and absolutely no one has the answer to that. As I stated earlier, it does not say that Wisconsin has to recognize gay and lesbian marriage. But as far as the fallout from, you know, how that impacts other laws that we have here, we're not sure yet because there are questions over whether federal programs or state programs that are paid for with federal dollars, whether this law will pertain to those things, for example, Medicaid. You know, there are lots of questions right now. And one person that I spoke with has said that, you know, they believe that's the next level of litigation because they believe states are going to fight this tooth and nail.
How do you think this is going to shape the debate in months or years to come now that this has passed? As you say, are we looking at just more series of lawsuits?
I think that's what a lot of people are thinking right now. They believe that we're just headed towards a future of lawsuits and who knows where it's going to go. But they don't believe that states who have basically prohibited gay and lesbian marriage are going to now say, okay, we will allow this and we'll be accepting of these things that they have made constitutional amendments to prohibit here. And so people believe that, you know, we're going to be seeing a lot of courtrooms.
So we're not over. The fight isn't over yet as far as these people are concerned.
Nowhere near over.
Well, Latoya, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much, Bonnie.
That was WUWM's LaToya Dennis. You'll find a link to her story on Wisconsin's reaction to the Supreme Court ruling striking down DOMA at WUWM.com. We'll be back with more of Lake Effect right after this short break. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. A national report out this week shows Wisconsin near the bottom of the list for access that poor children have to dental care. The report from the Pew Charitable Trusts showed that more than 71% of children enrolled in Medicaid in Wisconsin did not see a dentist during 2011. Only one state, Florida, fared worse in the study. Moreover, the state may soon have a shortage of dentists at hand. The state ranks 7th in the nation in the number of dentists approaching retirement age. We'll get some reaction to this data from a Milwaukee dentist in just a few minutes. But first, Jane Koppelman is Research Director for Children's Dental Policy for the Pew Trusts. She spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke and described the national landscape for access to dental care for poor children.
It's a crisis. We consider it a crisis. The Surgeon General last year also considered it a crisis. But what we see is that there are millions of low-income children that go without dental care every year because we have a system that doesn't have the capacity to treat them.
And why is that? Why are we in a situation where access is such an issue?
Well, there are a few things going on. One is that across the country, the federal government keeps tabs of areas that have shortages of healthcare providers, including dentists. And according to their figures, in 2012, there were 45 million Americans that were living in areas that had shortages of dentists. So whether you have insurance or don't have insurance, if you can't find a provider, you're in trouble. There is a second problem that is occurring, and that is that the number of dentists that are participating in the Medicaid program and accepting Medicaid patients is quite low. So even though it's an interesting irony, low-income children are more likely to have dental coverage than higher-income children, but they're less likely to get care. And we find that because so few providers accept Medicaid, and there are a variety of reasons for why they don't, Medicaid has become kind of like a hunting license for dental care. It gives you the opportunity to try and find a dentist who will treat you and or your children, and that can be a trial.
Well, and I would imagine in places where there is already a shortage of dentists to begin with, this is a problem that's compounded by the Medicare issue.
Yes, the two problems, work in combination to be causing a crisis.
Well, and you mentioned the dental shortage, and this would seem to speak to an issue that goes actually even beyond just the issue of poor children and their access to dental care. This would speak to an issue of access to dental care in general.
It's very true. Here at Pew, the Pew Children's Dental Campaign, we do focus solely on children, but it's absolutely true that there is an access crisis for adults as well. In fact, children, low-income children, are more apt to have dental insurance through Medicaid because it's a mandated benefit for children under Medicaid, but states have the option to provide it to adults, and we find that more and more states are choosing not to because of their budget problems.
What do we know about why there is a dentist shortage in general?
Well, there are a number of factors that play into the dental shortage, and one is that there's kind of like a misproportion of dentists operating in pockets of the country. Dentists, it's usually harder to find them in rural areas and in inner city areas. There are simply places that that dentists don't choose to live and practice. And even if we were to have nationally a ratio of dentists to patients that was adequate, which we don't, you'd still find them clustered in certain areas and scarce in other areas. So that's one issue. There's another issue too, which is In dentistry, there is no equivalent of a nurse practitioner or a physician's assistant, a mid-level provider that who commands a lower salary, who goes to school for a fewer number of years, who can do basic restorative care. Right now, it's only a dentist that can drill and fill teeth. So we're limited by their kind of exclusivity to most procedures, most dental procedures. One thing that a number of states are considering, probably about 15 right now, is expanding the dental workforce in one of two ways. One is to take the dental hygienist and to offer them more training to do temporary fillings and expand their scope of practice so that they can go in and do some basic restorative care for children and adults. And a dentist wouldn't have to. And the second proposal, which a number of states are considering and which Minnesota and Alaska have already implemented, is authorizing a new type of provider called a dental therapist. And again, this would be the equivalent of a nurse practitioner or a physician's assistant in the world of dentistry. And basically, a dental therapist can drill and fill teeth, and they are adequately trained to do this. So it increases the number of and types of providers that can go out and care for people. Right now, about 52 countries are using this dental therapist model to expand care. A lot of them are putting them in schools because it's a cost-effective way to get kids early and to treat their tooth decay at an earlier stage.
Well, and one of the points that the report makes is that there are implications, you know, we've heard about them for people using emergency rooms for routine or non-emergency medical care. But it seems that dental care also figures into that equation?
Yeah, dental care is a huge reason for a lot of emergency room visits. We did a report a couple of years ago where we found that there were nationwide, I believe in 2009, there were over 800,000 visits to hospital ERs for preventable dental conditions. And we believe that speaks to kind of a broken delivery system where people can't get care early on when they need it, and problems worsen and exacerbate, and all of a sudden they're to the point where people are in grave pain and they have to go to the ER.
What are the other policy implications you see for this? I mean, would you say that, I mean, are there incentive programs that ought to be undertaken to get more dentists to treat people in these underserved areas, rural and inner city locations?
There are a number of approaches to solving the access problem. Expanding the dental team by expanding the scope of dental hygienists and authorizing through changing state practice acts, authorizing mid-level dental providers is an important way to go. But it's also true that states should be raising their Medicaid reimbursement rates for dental care, which are across the board extremely low and is a major reason for why dentists are not accepting Medicaid patients. There are other reasons for why dentists don't accept Medicaid. There's always a hassle factor involved in the paperwork for a public program, and there are other factors, but that's one thing that they could do immediately, and they would probably see some impact. The research shows that when a state does raise its Medicaid rates, there usually is a higher utilization, but it doesn't always happen. So we know that raising Medicaid reimbursement rates is an important but not a sufficient answer to the access problem. There's something else that is figuring into this. Telehealth has taken hold in the medical field, not so much in dentistry, but we're seeing the potential that telehealth in dentistry holds for getting care to more people. And basically, if you have, let's say, for example, a dental hygienist that's based in a school or that is rotating in and out of a remote or rural area, they can communicate with a supervising dentist who doesn't have to be there on site. And with intraoral cameras and with being able to send x-rays electronically, a hygienist can, you know, take care of some of the problems of patients without a dentist having to be there. Telehealth holds greater promise if the mid-level provider that is in an underserved area can do some basic restorative care. But usually the law calls for checking in with a dentist before treatment can happen.
Well, Jane Koppelman, thank you so much for shedding some light on this for us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Jane Koppelman is Research Director for Children's Dental Policy for the Pew Trusts. She spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke about the report out this week showing serious problems with access to care for children receiving Medicaid benefits. That report showed particular challenges in Wisconsin, where 71.5% of children on Medicaid did not see a dentist in 2011. Dr. Monica Hebel is a dentist on Milwaukee's Northwest Side. She's also chair of the American Dental Association's Council on Access, Prevention, and Interprofessional Relations. She shared her perspective on the state's situation with Mitch Tyke. She says the Pew report squares with her experience.
Access to care for underserved poor children is difficult. I was surprised that we were as low on the list as we were, but we are the fifth lowest in Medicaid reimbursement rates across the country.
So then given that information, it doesn't necessarily surprise you that that we are as low as we are.
Right, and also our experience at the office with how many calls we get every day for people looking for a dentist under this program is just unbelievable. So, yeah, very clear that we have a problem.
The authors of the Pew Trusts report described the situation nationally as a crisis. Would you say is it a crisis in Wisconsin?
I would say it is a crisis in Wisconsin. We don't want to see what happened in Maryland with Diamante Driver, who was a 12-year-old boy who died of untreated dental disease, happen in Wisconsin. And so any attention we can get to this problem through media and advocacy awareness is really important.
Well, and what is the upshot? What happens to a childhood population that doesn't have regular access to dental care?
Well, this is a totally preventable disease. And so through education and prevention, other populations have really been able to eliminate dental disease for kids. It's just underserved kids that have the majority of the disease, and we can do something about that. That's what's kind of frustrating from my perspective, is that this is a solvable problem. It's a tough problem, but it's definitely solvable.
Well, as the head of the committee within the ADA that looks specifically at issues of access, I mean, is the chief issue in Wisconsin Medicaid and Medicare reimbursement rates?
Well, I think that this has to be attacked from multiple approaches, and that reimbursement rates are one part of that problem. But really, whatever program you have has to be economically sustainable. And that has been missing from this program in Wisconsin for quite some time through Republican governors, Democratic governors, Republican legislators, Democrats. Doesn't really matter, because people don't seem to place a high priority on oral health care. I think because they don't understand that your overall health depends on your oral health so much.
And how is that? Connect the dots for us. I mean, you mentioned that dental disease is something that's eminently preventable, but how does having unhealthy dental hygiene impact your overall health beyond just your teeth?
Well, the most simple is that when you have a cavity that doesn't get filled, it progresses and turns into an infection, which becomes a medical emergency and can swell your airway shut and go to your brain. And that's what happened to Diamante. But what other things that can happen is that if you have diabetes, you can have a really hard time controlling your gum disease. And if you have gum disease, you can have a really hard time controlling your sugars. And so diabetes patients should really have a dental home. So it's not just kids that have a difficult time in Wisconsin. I know that's the focus of this, but adults have an even worse time. So, and there's heart connections with heart disease, and also there are some studies that show some connections to low birth weight babies. And so some of those connections are a little bit tenuous, but as we go further along, more and more research is showing how important good oral health is to your overall health.
How How do you approach the issue of providing care to Medicaid patients in your own practice?
Well, we set aside Thursdays to be our Medicaid day, and it allows for us to, you know, do some practice management so that we can see as many patients as we can and be as productive as we can. But with the reimbursement rates at 35 cents on the dollar and overhead running 60, 65 cents, and that doesn't even include the dentist salary in that, it's difficult. And that's why it's not something that you can have an entire practice that's Medicaid, or your bottom line, you wouldn't be able to pay your bills. So that's why in the Central City, we used to have many dentists, but as the reimbursement didn't keep up with the economies, that people moved out, and we don't have as many dental practices in areas where you have a high concentration of underserved patients.
And you are not in the Central City, but how does your location, what about the physical access to care? Why are you where you are?
Well, we actually were on 27th and Wells. I practiced with my brother-in-law, and his father started the practice and has been involved with the Medicaid program since its inception. We've decided when the building was leaking and having many issues that we would move our practice in 2000. And we chose this location so that we could remain on three bus lines and remain accessible, because transportation is one of the big issues. So we decided that we would like to continue to provide care, but it's becoming increasingly difficult to do so under these economic constraints. We have federally qualified health centers across the country, which is a very important part of the safety net, but they get an enhanced rate, and that helps with the bottom line. Now, in exchange for that enhanced rate, they take uninsured patients as well. And so it's just, we tried to do contracting where a private dentist would be able to contract with a federally qualified health center and see some of those, so they could increase how many patients they were seeing and then pass through some of those rates. But the state ended that program. And so that's kind of disappointing, because it's difficult no matter what provider you have. It's difficult under these economic constraints to be able to take care of the need that's out there.
One of the ideas that the authors of this Pew report brought up, and one that's in practice next door in Minnesota, for example, is the issue or the idea of creating a new class of professionals who could provide kind of mid-level dental services and reduce the demand on dentists themselves. What is your take on the idea of either dental therapists as a class of provider, or expanding training for hygienists or other dental assistants to deal with some of the high demand?
Well, I think we already have mid-level providers to a certain extent. We have hygienists, and in the state of Wisconsin, they can practice in three settings, the settings where the underserved patients are, and bill directly to Medicaid. So I think that we have dental assistants and hygienists. Hygienists can't find jobs, and there's capacity for dentists to treat patients right now with the economic downturn. And so I think that we need to more efficiently and effectively use the workforce that we have, rather than to create training programs, which has an expense all on its own, and have mid-levels that would go out and need the same equipment that I need, so the overhead would be the same, and it wouldn't be sustainable under the current economic payment system. And so I just don't see it as having a very big effect. It would just be another drop in the bucket, and it really isn't going to solve the access problem. We really need to get out of the idea that we're going to treat our way out of this problem. We need to educate and prevent our way out of this problem. And so the ADA has a program. It's a community dental health coordinator, which is a person, might be a hygienist, an assistant, or just somebody who has an interest in this area and would be taught to do dental education, navigation, and then go out into the community, hopefully be from that community, so that they can meet patients where they are, and then refer those patients back to the dentist, so that for those more difficult needs and where you need the equipment, that they would be going to see a dentist. I think it's really important that we keep the team intact, because what's happening in Minnesota is the independent practice of dental therapy can lead to another barrier where a patient would be seen by a therapist but then have to go for something and have to find another location, another dentist, some other location. And that's very difficult for people.
If a Medicaid recipient wanted to get into your practice to see you or another dentist, how long a wait do they have at this stage?
We doubled the number of people who are covered back some years ago. So we went from 500,000 people covered to 1 million. And we didn't do anything to the network of providers and didn't make it so that they had economic purchasing power. And so right now, you need somebody. Coverage is good. But you need a wary consumer, somebody who wants to get this care, and they need to get on the phone and call and get an appointment, you know, sometimes months away. And that can be really frustrating and then hard to remember when the day finally comes and arrives. And so I think that's why the navigation is so important, because it really is all about relationships. And if a navigator had a relationship with a dentist and they triage a patient and find out that that person needs to get in right away, they can help that patient navigate the system. And just having people who are doing the treatment in a couple more areas is not going to make the difference. We need to teach people how to take care of their teeth so that they can maintain their own oral health. We need to teach them about nutrition, stay away from soda, Kool-Aid, and juice, and make sure that they value prevention so that they don't get into the trouble in the first place.
Monica Hebel, thank you so much for sharing your perspective with us.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Monica Hebel is a dentist in private practice on Milwaukee's Northwest Side. She's also chair of the American Dental Association's Council on Access, Prevention, and Interprofessional Relations, and a former president of the Wisconsin Dental Association. She spoke with Mitch Tyke. There is a link to the report from the Pew Trusts on access to dental care for poor children at wuwm.com/legeffect. We talk with astronomy contributor Gene Creighton more than once in a blue moon, but up next, it's the moon itself that takes center stage. Lake Effect returns with that in just a moment on WUWM. Welcome back to Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. It's great to have your company this morning. It is time at the very end of the month for our astronomical chat with Gene Creighton, who joins us every month to do just that. Welcome, Gene.
Hello, Bonnie.
Great to see you. And this month, we are going to conclude our little mini moon series that we've had. Last month, we talked about various things about the moon, and I thought we would conclude with it this month, starting with blue moons. They're not really blue, are they?
No, they're not. And frankly, I don't know where the expression comes from, but what a blue moon is when we have two full moons in the same month, which happens every 2-3 years. So it's not that unusual.
And that's just because the lunar cycle is whatever it is.
It's 29 and a half days.
Right. So it's
so
not even.
From time to time, you'll squeeze two of those in 1 month.
So that's all it is. There's nothing else.
That's all there is.
Okay. So, well, if the moon isn't blue, it can be red, though.
It sure can. For the same reason that the sun can appear reddish when it's close to the horizon. So if you think of the moon as a disk, its light is going to come through the atmosphere. The lower it is in the sky, the more atmosphere it travels through, plus that atmosphere has more particles than higher in the sky. So that means that if you think of light as wavelengths, so I'm drawing here for you, but hopefully we can visualize it, even those of us who are listening to me. We have a wave that has a long wavelength and blue light that has short wavelength. So it's from crest to crest is much shorter. Red light sees particles that are about the size, let's say, of my fist. And those particles really do stop the red light. They get blocked. They block the red light. Whereas the blue light that's much shorter comes fast and slams into the blue particle and gets scattered. So when I'm looking at the disk of the moon, I see more likely the redder photons than the bluer photons. The blue photons are busy getting scattered in all directions, which is why the sky overall looks blue, but the moon itself is going to look reddish if it's low in the sky.
And that happened the other night on the so-called supermoon full moon, which I understand really wasn't.
Really wasn't. But it is possible to get a supermoon, and that is when the moon looks bigger. Now, we know that objects that are close to other objects look bigger overall. We know that that's how our eye works. But even setting that tendency aside, we know that the moon physically looks bigger because it's closer to us. So its distance from the Earth changes at the few percent level. So there are times when the moon at its closest can look up to 12% bigger. So for people who notice the moon, they'll see, wow, that looks a lot bigger, more spectacular than they expect.
Brighter in the sky.
And brighter as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's because the orbit of the moon is not circular.
Not precisely circular. That's right. It's close. But at the 3% level, sometimes it's a little closer than others, which of course would be a few thousand miles.
Right. And so, enough to make that difference.
Enough.
How often does that happen given the orbit? How often do we actually get a supermoon?
Once a year.
Once a year? Okay. Yeah. So not very often, but at least once a year.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, but I think that people who look at the moon often enough will notice that this is spectacular, or maybe it's even more noticeable for people who really don't look up very much, and suddenly the moon catches their breath. You know, how spectacular some of these celestial phenomena can be if you say you're on vacation or there's a special event and you notice something like a beautiful full moon, it kind of gives the whole experience more magic.
Well, of course, the full moon is gorgeous at night, and it's also very romantic for those of us who think in those terms. But oftentimes, you know, when I'm walking to work or something in the morning, I'll see the full moon or even the half moon or sliver moons during the daytime. So when does that happen in the orbits of the various – our planet as well as the moon?
I'm glad you asked, because a lot of people notice the moon during the day and they're a little alarmed by that because, you know, according to all those nursery rhymes, the sun is up in the day and the moon is up at night and they shouldn't get confused. But the fact of the matter is the moon shows different portions of its bright side depending on where it is with respect to the sun. So, for example, if I have the sun to my left, then the moon is going to appear to me full because I see exactly what the sun sees. But if it's at, say, 90 degrees from the sun, then I see a half moon, what you call a half moon, which, of course, is half of half a quarter moon. And then they're only 90 degrees apart, which means that if the sun is high in the sky, then it could either be at the horizon, the eastern or the western horizon. And if it's even less than a quarter moon but a crescent, then it's only going to be a few degrees on either side of the sun, so I could easily see it during the day.
So this is not uncommon at all?
No. In fact, you have equal chances of seeing the moon during the day and the night. It's just that typically when we see it in the nighttime, it's fuller, so it's more dramatic.
I was going to ask if the, you know, just the general level of brightness in the sky might make it tougher to see when the sun is full.
Sure,
out.
Sure. You're much less likely to notice it if the competition is the sun.
Right. But it's there.
Yeah.
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 Okay. And you mentioned the part that we see, the side, there's really not a side of the moon, but there is a face that we see. Is that a good description of it, or is there a better way to describe it?
I would say a side. So the near side, what we call the near side, so it's practically 50% of the surface of the moon. It's a little more, but let's just say it's 50% of the moon that we can see. But the other 50% is always pointing, what we call the far side of the moon, is always pointing away from us. And the only reason why we know what it looks like is because we've sent machines there. It never points that side, which, by the way, looks quite different than the side we can see. That side is always away from the Earth. And the reason for that is that over time, the period, so the time it takes for the moon to rotate around itself is locked in to the same period that it takes to go around the Earth. So as it moves slowly around the Earth over time, and I guess there's no real way to show that other than to kind of do the experiment for yourself. Take an orange, draw some silly face on one side, and try and move it so that at the quarter turn, it will have moved a quarter. So when in its orbit it has traveled 90 degrees, that it will show you a quarter face, and you'll see that you'll be seeing the same silly face all the time.
So it's not that it's not actually rotating.
No.
On an axis, it's just the way it happens to be turning and at the speed it happens to be turning.
That's right. And frankly, this is not surprising because the gravitational pull of the Earth and tidal forces will make it most efficient if it rotated at the same rate. So this is not uncommon. This is not just for our moon. For many moons, this is true, that the rotational period and the revolutionary period is the same.
So Pink Floyd was right. There is a dark side of the moon.
There is always a dark side of the moon, but that's not the far side of the moon. The dark side could be pointing in our direction or away, but the far side is always away from us.
So the far side is always the far side.
That's right.
All right. Well, Jean, as always, great to talk to you. I hope you have a great summer.
Thank you.
And we'll talk to you in about a month.
Excellent.
Professor Jean Creighton is the director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium on the campus of UW-Milwaukee, and she is our regular astronomy contributor. We'll take a short break and then the effort to create a definitive encyclopedia of Milwaukee. Lake Effect returns in just a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. It's great to have you with us. From the campaign to save Gertie the Duck to the function of baby hammocks, the Encyclopedia of Milwaukee mines hidden gems of local history. UW-Milwaukee academics are teaming up with other experts to prepare both online and print copies, and they're set for release in 2017. The digital version will be interactive. UWM history professor Dr. Amanda Seligman is the project's leader. She explained to Lake Effect's Amy Kiley the purpose of the encyclopedia.
We really had a vision to share Milwaukee's history with people of the area in a really systematic fashion. We want people to be able to find what they're interested in at short notice, whether it's in a print version or an online version. We want to make the information about Milwaukee's past available to people for a whole variety of reasons.
In the era when scholars volunteer for Wikipedia and write blogs, why did your colleagues and you feel creating a new source was better than augmenting an existing one?
We wanted to have a go-to starting point for people who were doing research on Milwaukee history. So, you know, blogs are created over time. People put things in according to their whimsy, and it's not systematic. It doesn't show the whole of Milwaukee in a really kind of rigorous fashion to people. Wikipedia is not about Milwaukee, and Wikipedia, while it's a wonderful source in many ways, is not written by experts. It's not edited by experts. Anyone can contribute to Wikipedia, and you can't interpret. You can't trust that what you've written stays there. So when putting together the Encyclopedia of Milwaukee, we wanted to really make an authoritative statement about what we know and what we think we can know about Milwaukee's history in the 21st century.
What does compiling such a work entail, and how long will the process take?
Oh, it's a huge job. It's actually a 10-year project. We started working on it in 2008, and there were a couple of years of planning, and we are projecting a publication date of 2017. The work involved is large-scale project management. So we had to think about how do you create the website? How do you create the book? How do you find graduate students who can write a bunch of entries? How do you commission entries from non-graduate student people out in the community who are experts on their particular topics? How do you plan the contents, including figuring out exactly what should be in and how long everything should be? And how do you keep a project going over a 10-year period? So there's all sorts of tasks that are involved in putting together this project. Oh, yes, and of course there's fundraising as well.
to accomplish all that? What are the roles or job descriptions involved in the process?
Well, we have a very large team of people who are working on this, doing different tasks. We have a core editorial team. That's myself and my colleague Margot Anderson, who have been planning the project from the beginning. We seated an editorial board consisting of local experts in Milwaukee history that include archivists, librarians, other history faculty members from Marquette, and John Gerda, who is, of course, Mr. Milwaukee History. We also have a core of graduate student staff who are working on it. There's an IT team who's working on it. There's development people who are working on it. The list kind of goes on and on.
Can you talk about why you received a $250,000 grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and the costs of what you're doing?
Like I said, it's a huge project. And when I suggested who all those people were who were involved in it, that you have to compensate them. You can't get graduate students, for example, to work on a project for free. They need to be able to support themselves while they're going to school and also have a little bit to live on, and et cetera. So the costs for the project add up to about $2 million. Every time we've tweaked the budget one way or another, it still ends up around $2 million. So we knew that in order to make the project possible, we had to raise funds for it. And so when we began planning seriously in 2009, we had our eye on a particular program that's hosted by the National Endowment for the Humanities that would allow us to really do a lot of work on the project. So that's why we seated that editorial board, to really plan the contents and think about what would exactly go into the grant application we gave to the National Endowment for the Humanities. And we also convinced the university to offer up quite a bit of funding in cost shares in the event that we got the grant. So we are able to pay graduate students and other staff, commission maps, have images, write entries, and plan the website all using those funds.
Some of the elements you just named are multimedia. How does the online version of the encyclopedia make use of that format in terms of digitized primary source materials and things like that?
As I suggested, we do have two versions of the project, a print version and a digital version. The digital version is going to have everything that's in the print edition and then some extra special features. We're pretty book-oriented, so we think of them using these kind of bookish terms that we made up, but we don't usually use them in public. I'll let you know what they are today. They're the underbook and the overbook. But you won't see that when you go to the website. What you'll see when you go to the website is a button next to an entry that says, "Want to know more?" And if you push that button, you'll get access to those special features. The overbook lets you know about how other people who have read in the project think about it, and lets you have the opportunity to leave comments yourself. So we'll be able to see what readers really think of the project, where they think we made mistakes, I hope not too many, what they think of when they look at the topic that they're reading about. And we hope that they'll also provide more information than we were able to put into a short authoritative entry. I've been really impressed on our Facebook page. People want to share information. People are hungry to share the information they have about the past. And so the overbook will be a place where people can see what has been said by other people and fill in those gaps they think are there and contribute their own ideas. The underbook, by contrast, has the mission of teaching readers where historical information comes from. How do we know what we know about the past? And there's going to be a couple things that will happen. When they hit that button that turns on the underbook, the first thing they're going to get are footnotes. So if you think about a standard encyclopedia entry, just imagine it in your mind's eye. You might see an author's name attached to it, but you won't see where the information comes from. So the first thing we want to show readers is the information in an encyclopedia was not just handed down from on high with no author to it, but that the person who did the research went somewhere, looked for that information, and put it together. So that's one feature, is the footnotes. We're also going to digitize primary sources that are held in our wonderful local archives so that teachers, for example, who want to teach about a particular topic in Milwaukee history, also have some primary sources that their students can work with and say, oh, that's really how that knowledge that's in that primary source went into the writing about it as well. And then finally, the feature that we're kind of most excited about is what we call understories. Again, a very awkward name for something we think is pretty cool. These are stories about how the researchers and writers for the project experienced the research process. So let me just give one example of that. We have a really great undergraduate student who's working with us right now, and she was invited into the home of a postcard collector in Shorewood. And she spent a couple of weeks sitting with this collection of pre-World War II postcards featuring Milwaukee history. And there was one picture that really arrested her attention. It was a picture of what she called baby hammocks. It was cribs suspended from a ceiling. It startled us, I think, in the 21st century, because clearly that does not meet 21st century safety standards. You would not allow babies to hang out in a place that they could just climb out of and fall on the ground. But she kept coming back to them, and she wanted to know what these baby hammocks were. But it was impossible for her to research something that was a picture with a word that she made up attached to it. So she was talking to everyone about it. And she and I were talking about it one day, and it finally dawned on me, you know, there's a book we have that describes something that might be connected to that. And when she looked at the book, she said, oh, this is a fresh air pavilion for babies and mothers, gives mothers a little respite, and also prevents tuberculosis in the early 20th century. So then she was able, once she had the actual term for what it was a fresh air pavilion, then she was able to go out and find more information about it. So she's written a wonderful understory about that research process that will show the stops and starts that researchers experience. When you put something in an encyclopedia, you don't put it there just because you knew it off the top of your head, but you really had to work hard to find it, and that's one example of how that happens.
What are the advantages and challenges of starting with both digital and hard copy formats versus digitizing from an existing print resource?
So that's a great question. We were initially thinking that we would just do a print edition because we knew that there were extra costs attached to doing an online project, but we really wanted to make this information available to the public. But there isn't funding available for straight print projects anymore. When we went to the National Endowment for the Humanities just to talk about the project, they said, you know, if you're going to get funding from us, it has to be digital. So then we began to think about how do these two kinds of sources for the public interact? What are the different things they would do for readers? One thing that the print edition does is it will last forever, right? That as long as it's preserved in a library, people can always go look up what's there. Whereas stuff that's online, formats may change. You have to update your website. The university is committed to this project, but what happens if there's radical changes that we don't quite catch up with? The print edition is a way of making something permanent. It's also really tangible. People really love to touch these books. There's other city encyclopedias for other cities around the United States. And when I take them to show people, people spend a lot of time just flipping through them, really interacting with the images that they see. And that really speaks to me about how important it is to have a book available for people, even in the 21st century. We know that people will use this in a really intimate way in their homes, and we want to make that book available to them. Younger people, of course, are more likely to go to the digital edition, right? Not every school is going to be able to afford to purchase a coffee table book for every classroom where they might want to study Milwaukee history. And having a website available 24/7 will allow students and teachers and anyone else who uses the internet to find the information that they need when they need it.
Finally, what are one to three things you learned about Milwaukee during this project that surprised you that you didn't know before?
Oh, you know, we're still sort of in the middle of the project, so I haven't learned all the things that there are to learn. We've put so much energy into planning it. I'll tell you that one of my favorite stories that I pull out all the time is about Gertie the duck. I don't know if you know about Gertie. A lot of people who lived through this remember it, but then younger people don't necessarily. Gertie was a duck at the end of World War II who laid her eggs in a very inconvenient spot where her eggs were in danger right along the river. And the whole city rallied around rescuing those eggs and putting them in a safer location. And it transfixed the city. And you can imagine the time when everybody is so war-weary in 1945. And they want to have something to distract them from the bad times. And Gertie the duck functioned to pull people in the city together to think about something else that they actually could accomplish. Ultimately, of course, the United States prevailed in World War II, but Milwaukeeans could get a real sense of being able to do something together with that little duck and her family. And, you know, there were books written about Gertie the duck, and I went and pulled one out of the public library recently to show my own kids. They weren't too interested because they didn't understand yet how significant it is. But I love to tell people that story because I think it illustrates that there's things about Milwaukee that are really interesting stories that didn't happen anywhere else but also have a peek at bigger things that were going on in the world.
Right here at Water in Wisconsin, where our studios are, there's a sculpture or a brass sculpture, I guess, of a duck. That seems kind of random. Is that Gertie?
That's Gertie.
So you come to visit WUWM and you can meet Gertie.
Right, exactly.
Well, Dr. Amanda Seligman, thank you for joining us on Lake Effect.
Thank you.
UWM's Dr. Amanda Seligman is the editor of the Encyclopedia of Milwaukee. She spoke with Lake Effect's Amy Kiley. we close out today's show with this bit of city trivia. Today marks the 20th anniversary of the Clements' famous racing sausages. On this date in 1993, the original sausages, bratwurst, Polish, and Italian, came to life. Originally, the sausages were mere animations featured each game day on the then county stadium scoreboard.
Wearing number one is the Clements bratwurst. Wearing number two is Clements Polish sausage. And wearing number three is the Clements Italian sausage. Who will get to County Stadium and cross home plate first?
But on this day, as the animated sausages made their way to the stadium on screen, suddenly the left field doors opened and a trio of real live racing sausages charged toward home, to the surprise and delight of fans and even players.
Congratulations to the Clements Bratwurst on victory in today's very special sausage race. Special thanks to McDill Design for their assistance with today's incredible edible sausage race.
Clements Hot Dog would join the live race later in the 1990s, followed by Chorizo in 2007. We wish all the racing sausages a very happy anniversary. You can watch a video of the original race featuring the audio we just played at our website, WUWM.com. Thanks so much to the Milwaukee Brewers for the tape. And that's all the time we have today. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for joining us. Before we go, it is the final days of WUWM's fiscal year, and we are inviting you to make a contribution before Sunday. It's also your chance to win the Radiolab Live VIP package, which includes two exclusive balcony box seats to the live show at the Riverside Theater, which is on Friday, October 11th. There's also a special pre-show rehearsal and meet and greet with Robert Krulwich and Jad Abumrad. Make your year-end contribution today at WUWM.com/give or call us now at 414-270-1225. That's 414-270-1225 with your support and for your chance to win. Thanks so much for all of your support all year. I hope you can be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next. Thank you.